This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Tuesday, December the 16th, 2025. And as always, we'll start in the world section, and I'll try to work us through as many articles and sections as we can cover in the time that we have today. So, our first headline from today's world section of the Christian Science Monitor reads, "Attack on U.S. forces in Syria tests anti-ISIS mission and warming ties." Syria's need to rapidly reconstitute its security forces has left them vulnerable to infiltration by former rebels with jihadist sympathies, at the very time that President Ahmed al-Shara has been cultivating ties with the U.S. The date on this article is December the 15th. It is by Dominique Sogoy, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor, and the dateline is Basel, Switzerland. Just weeks after Syria joined the U.S.-led anti-ISIS coalition, a deadly attack on American forces in the ancient city of Palmyra has exposed gaps in Damascus' vetting of its personnel as it works to rebuild its security apparatus and court the United States. The attack, which local reports said was by a member of Syria's security forces, killed two American soldiers and a civilian translator meeting with Syrian personnel, and underscored the persistence of jihadist ideology among former rebels now serving in the army. "You are the enemies of God," the assailant said before shooting, according to local accounts. Analysts said the attack reflects vulnerabilities created by the rapid expansion of Syrian security forces and assessed it as an unsuccessful attempt by the Islamic State, ISIS, to derail warming ties between Washington and Damascus. A Syrian official said checks would be carried out to establish whether the attacker had a direct organizational link to ISIS or whether he just had held its ideas. A subsequent statement from the Interior Ministry merely said an ISIS member infiltrated a meeting of Syrian and U.S. forces. "It was a member of security forces that shot the American," says a Palmyra-based Syrian who formerly served in the anti-ISIS coalition and asked to withhold his name. "There would be no one else who could get in. I know them. Many of these guys have an ISIS mindset against the Jews, against Americans," that kind of rhetoric. It was the first attack on U.S. personnel in Syria to cause casualties since the fall of Bashar Assad's government in December 2024. It was also the first deadly incident involving U.S. forces there since a 2019 suicide bombing in Manbij in northern Syria. The assault occurred as U.S. soldiers were in Palmyra to support ongoing counter-ISIS operations, Pentagon spokesperson Sean Parnell said. Partner forces killed the attacker, according to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. President Donald Trump framed the incident as an attack against both the U.S. and Syria, noting it took place in a very dangerous part of Syria that is not fully controlled by the government, and warning that a very serious retaliation would follow. The attack came at a delicate time in U.S.-Syrian relations. President Trump, who has spoken of a prosperous future for Syria, has praised and recently hosted Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara, a former rebel leader who toppled the Assad regime and has sought to distance himself from his jihadist past. "Disrupting the growing cooperation between Washington and Damascus is a critical objective for ISIS, which was militarily defeated in Syria in 2019, but continues to carry out low-level insurgent and terrorist operations." It should come as no surprise that ISIS attempted to infiltrate the government forces and then used the infiltrators to attack and kill U.S. service members in order to drive a wedge between Washington and Damascus, says Brian Carter, research manager and analyst at the Critical Threats Project at the American Enterprise Institute. "This attack will have a very limited impact on the U.S.-Syrian relationship. The Trump administration is already exclusively blaming ISIS and emphasizing the importance of the partnership with the Syrian government," he says. A poorly paved highway connects Damascus to Palmyra, famous for its monumental ruins dating back to the second millennium BC. The desolate steppe landscape between the capital and Palmyra is cut off from phone networks and riddled with mines. The Badia region, which stretches through central and eastern Syria, holds a significant strategic importance, encompassing key population centers, borders, and critical military supply routes. Its remoteness and rugged terrain turned it into a refuge for ISIS cells. According to Interior Ministry spokesman Nuruddin al-Baba, senior figures from the International Anti-ISIS Coalition and Syria's Internal Security Command were conducting a joint field tour Saturday in the Badia region. The visit concluded at a fortified internal security base. At the gate of this base, an attack took place committed by someone affiliated with the ISIS organization, the spokesperson said. Palmyra itself was under ISIS control twice during the Syrian civil war. The American base at Al-Tanf, established in 2016 in the context of global anti-ISIS operations, sits roughly 100 miles south of Palmyra. Following Mr. Assad's ouster in December 2024, the U.S. retained a military presence in Syria as part of its ongoing campaign against ISIS. There are about 1,000 troops, according to the Pentagon, although President Trump has signaled the intention to withdraw them earlier this year. The attack comes weeks after Syria became the 90th member of the U.S.-led global coalition against ISIS. Compounding concerns about ideological screening, former rebels of widely differing backgrounds now oversee a security apparatus once used by the Assad regime to crush dissent, forcibly disappear opponents, and kill hundreds of thousands of people. The Syrian security and military forces come from a variety of ideological backgrounds, ranging from jihadist groups to both religious and secular nationalist factions, says Ayman Jawad al-Tamimi, a Syrian-based analyst who specializes in jihadist movements. Of particular concern, Mr. Tamimi notes, is the nature of ideological instruction reportedly being delivered to recruits. Right now, there is a broader concern about the Sunni-centric religious instruction being given to recruits within the military in particular, says Mr. Tamimi, noting that it seems that the military and security forces have also recruited former members of ISIS. Today's dominant security actors are linked to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which emerged from Syria's jihadist movements. An al-Qaeda offshoot, the group rebranded itself away from global jihad toward a narrowly Syrian nationalist project under the command of Mr. al-Shara. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham battled ISIS while seeking to eliminate rival factions and assert territorial control. Mr. al-Shara's break from global jihad years ago and recent visit to the White House has been met with discontent from more radical peers, both Syrian and foreign. Meanwhile, expedited recruitment efforts have made it possible for individuals with a jihadist ideology to join state institutions. Some of those former members may have clearly abandoned the Islamic State's ideology, whereas others may still adhere to it, notes Mr. Tamimi, who is a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. In the case of this incident, however, it is the first of its kind in which someone supportive of the group and recruited into the security forces carried out an attack from within. The attack also aligns with what appears to be a deliberate shift in ISIS activity inside Syria since Mr. Assad's ouster. ISIS attacks have been typically focused on the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces in which Syrian Kurds play a leadership role. Recently, however, it has claimed operations in locations controlled by the Syrian government, including major cities like Homs, Hama, Damascus, and Aleppo. It is likely that the group was keeping a low profile within Syrian government-held areas for security reasons as its cells moved and positioned themselves, even as its propaganda repeatedly railed against the government. But now, in order to demonstrate credibility, the group is claiming more attacks, says Mr. Kamimi. Mr. Baba, the Interior Ministry spokesperson, rejected reports that the attacker held a leadership role in Syria's internal security forces. He noted that more than 5,000 personnel operate under the Internal Security Command in the Badia region, with weekly vetting procedures in place. In an assessment conducted earlier this month, authorities flagged concerns about the attacker's ideological orientation. Mr. Baba said disciplinary action had been planned. The Interior Ministry later issued a statement saying that an ISIS member infiltrated the meeting. It reiterated Syria's commitment to fighting ISIS in cooperation and coordination with the U.S.-led coalition. Palmyra residents say arrests have taken place and that U.S. coalition warplanes have been flying over the city since the attack. Despite the gravity of the attack, Mr. Tamimi does not expect a fundamental rupture in U.S.-Syrian relations. Mr. Trump has made clear he supports and stands by Shara, who did a very good job of courting him, he says. But there will be more pressure on the Syrian government from the U.S. to vet recruits into the security and military forces and root out suspected ISIS infiltrators and supporters. And again, this particular article was written by Dominique Sogoy, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor. It reads, many Senegalese are braving dangerous seas to get to Europe. Can they be convinced to stay? In Senegal, poverty makes young people embark on dangerous boats to reach Europe. Parents and local leaders seek solutions to encourage them to stay. The data on this article is December the 15th. It is by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor, and Isuli Diedihu, who is a contributor. And the datelines are Joal and Thiaroy sur Mer, Senegal, La Orotava, Dinanarif. Papa Sadi's teenage sons left in the dark. One morning in 2020, he woke up and Abdoulaye and Suleimani weren't there. He waited 2 days, then three. He asked about, but deep down, he already knew. Pape had warned them about the risks of the perilous days at sea. After all, he'd made the trip to the Canary Islands himself over a decade ago. For over a week, I couldn't eat or sleep, he recalls from the courtyard of his sister's home in the seaside town of Joal, now a popular departure point for migration to Europe. I knew the route and that it shouldn't have taken so long. Nearly 64,000 people arrive illegally in Spain in 2024, with a record 46,843 landing in the Canary Islands, the country's closest point to Africa, from the West African coast, according to the Spanish Interior Ministry. Aid groups say that an additional 10,457 people died or disappeared trying to reach Spain that year, most of them attempting the Atlantic route from West Africa, whose strong currents have made it the most dangerous sea crossing in the world for migrants. Many were departing coastal towns and villages like Joal, where families who once relied on the sea for jobs now struggle to put food on the table, as industrial fishing increasingly puts traditional fishermen out of work and strips the ocean of precious resources. But, as Pape knew only too well, if the risks of leaving are clear, so are the rewards. Nestled among Joel's simple concrete homes and dirt lanes are stately, freshly painted two-story houses built with money sent home from migrants. This tempts those who can't make ends meet with the promise of a life in Europe. Last year, remittances accounted for 11.6% of Senegal's gross domestic product, according to the World Bank. Many here say it's better to die at sea than next to the sea because you didn't have enough to eat, says Mustafa Diouf, a local anti-immigration activist who is trying to convince young people like Abdoulaye and Suleimani Sadi to remain in Senegal. Two decades ago, When Mr. Diouf himself boarded a boat bound for Europe, he had felt that same tug. Now, as Senegal's coastal villages empty out of their young people, he is trying to make the opposite pitch, stay and try to build something better here instead. The stakes of this fight are calculated in the lives of those like Abdoulaye and Souleymane, the stability of fishing communities like Joal, and even the future of this country. At a time when Senegal looks to build its industries and assert independence from the West, the country needs its young people. But leaders, activists, and parents face an uphill battle to keep them at home. International migration is growing, and historical evidence suggests that as poorer countries approach middle-income status, people tend to leave more often, not less. Senegal now faces a quandary affecting countries across the region. When the promise of Europe burns so bright, what would it take to keep young people at home? I told Abdoulaye and Souleymane, "Watch out, it's not better over there," says Pape. But they were stubborn and determined. They went anyway. Luckily, they survived. Abdoulaye Sadi didn't want to disappoint his father, but he knew he couldn't stay. He worked as a hairdresser in Joal and fished with his dad and brother on the weekends. Still, he found himself calling his mother in mainland Spain each month, asking her to wire him cash. In Europe, he thought he could earn more and help his family out. When Abdoulaye boarded the wooden fishing boat along with 180 others that day in 2020, he knew the risks. But he had grown up on the water. The waves didn't scare him. Nothing prepared him, however, for the harrowing voyage to the Canary Islands. The trip was supposed to take 5 days, but halfway there, the boat got lost. After a week at sea, it ran out of gas. The passengers could see the Canary Island of El Hierro, which their phone's GPS told them was only 11 miles away, but they were trapped, the last of their food and water gone. For 4 days, the boat drifted agonizingly toward the shore. In desperation, some people drank seawater and became violently ill or dehydrated. When his fellow passengers began to die, Abdoulaye watched as they were thrown overboard. "I couldn't look at the sea for a long time after that," he says from a hillside cafe in La Orotava on the Canary Island of Tenerife. "Every time I would go to the beach here, I always thought of that trip, of the people who died." Like many young men who leave Senegal, Abdoulaye grew up in a fishing family. Each evening, Pape came home with fresh fish for dinner. But by the time Abdoulaye began joining him on fishing trips as a teenager, they often returned empty-handed. The family's problem is one that many fishing communities along the length of Senegal's coast, where the majority of fish populations are in a state of collapse, according to a report from the Environmental Justice Foundation. Small-scale fishers like the Sadis have seen their catch decrease by over half in recent years and say their living conditions are also plummeting. One of the main culprits is the industrial fishing boats roaming the Senegalese coast, dragging tens of thousands of tons of fish into their nets each year. While most of these ships are registered as Senegalese, many are in fact controlled by foreign investors from Europe and China and often flout restrictions on where they catch and how much. That has squeezed the local fishing industry and also altered the way Senegalese eat. Traditionally, fish has been the centerpiece of local diets and the star attraction of beloved dishes like, the boudienne, a plateful of stewed whitefish served over a bed of rice and vegetables. But as Senegalese fish exports quadrupled between 2008 and 2018, the amount of fish available to households here fell by half, according to a 2022 study in the journal Marine Policy. Losing fish meant losing tradition, U.S.-based Senegalese chef Pierre Thiam told the Associated Press. In November 2024, the European Union announced that it would not be renewing an agreement with Senegal that allowed European boats to fish surplus stocks in Senegalese waters in exchange for yearly payments of around $1.8 million. Although European boats are responsible for only a small portion of the total catch in Senegalese waters, many Senegalese see the end of the EU agreement as a positive sign for the local fishing industry, in particular traditional fishers. Compared to 2 years ago, we've already seen a difference, says Abdourahmane Diouf, a member of Joal CLPA, the local artisanal fisheries council. Revenues are going up. Marine life, especially octopus and sardines, is starting to come back. But for small-scale fishermen, so far, little has changed. Inside the Joal port, on a recent morning, men in rubber boots scurry around sorting fish and packing them into refrigerated trucks destined for the international market. But local authorities estimate that nearly 90% of fishermen in the area work in the artisanal sector, and out on the beach, dozens of their wooden fishing boats sway idly near the shore. Meanwhile, fishermen crouch under the awning of a building with nowhere to go. Three women attempting to sell octopus say they do so in vain. Most middlemen will end up buying from the big industrial boats. Poppy still tries to go out to sea each day with his 16-year-old son, Ibrahima, who dropped out of school to help his dad fish. Together, they catch miniature sharks to sell to hotels and clients in Ghana. Whatever the pair doesn't sell, they exchange for fish to feed their family of 10. In addition to Abdoulaye and Suleimane, Papi's eldest son and his first wife live in Bilbao, Spain, where she earns a living braiding tourists' hair. In good times, Abdoulaye sends a few hundred dollars or a few hundred euros to his father, enough to pay for the family's food for a month. But inflation and poor job prospects mean it's getting harder and harder for any of them to send money home. Meanwhile, Pape's two other wives work odd jobs, collecting plastic garbage from the beach and selling it to recycling centers or selling small amounts of fish at the port. "We have enough money to eat, but not much else," he says, crossing his arms on a low bench in the courtyard while a sheep bleats in the next room. "I can never relax. There are so many mouths to feed." But although Pape struggles to provide for his family, his friends and neighbors call him the little rich guy because he has sons in Europe. His second wife has started pleading with him to allow Ibrahima to migrate to Europe so she can have a child who's made it, too. "If Ibrahima comes to me one day and says he wants to leave on a boat, I'll refuse," says Pape, shaking his head. "If his brothers can sponsor him for a visa, maybe," he says, "but on a boat, no way." The promise of legal status is one of the key factors driving so many Senegalese migrants toward Spain in particular. The country has long had open policies toward new arrivals that many of its European neighbors In May, its government simplified the procedure for obtaining residency and work permits. It has also expanded its circular migration program, which provides short-term visas for West Africans to come to Spain for seasonal work, mostly in agriculture, before returning home. But the number of people who qualify for the circular migration program, which involves a lengthy interview process, remains small. And because it doesn't provide a longer-term perspective, people don't get enough skills to invest back in Senegal, says Ravenna Sost, a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute Europe. For migrants who are able to remain in Spain, meanwhile, there are other challenges. Far-right and anti-immigrant parties have gained ground across Europe, including some regions of Spain. Despite the country's open policies, polls show a growing majority of Spaniards support the deportation of both unauthorized migrants and those with legal status who commit crimes. Abdoulaye says he has, at times, experienced horrible racism and battled assumptions that migrants like him are only in Spain to benefit from the country's social security net instead of working to integrate into Spanish life. "He just wants to be treated as a normal person," he says, "but instead everybody thinks all black people just got off the boat." Many unauthorized migrants also remain stuck working low-paying, under-the-table jobs that don't make them enough money to send home, much less pay their own bills. Families think that you arrive in Europe and it's an El Dorado, but it is exactly the opposite, says Alun Fall, president of Sama Chance, the Dakar-based nonprofit, provides newly returned migrants with temporary housing and psychological support to help them reintegrate into Senegalese life. Some people have had very intense experiences. Many have been exploited, says Mr. Fall. They're ashamed to return to their families and say it didn't work out. Mustafa Diouf, the migration activist, is determined to stop young people from leaving Senegal in the first place. In 2006, he was one of the more than 30,000 people who left West Africa for the Canary Islands, part of a historic migration wave that lasted until 2008. The majority came from Senegal, where global price shocks collided with an erratic rainy season that led to low crop outputs for farmers. But soon after his arrival in Spain, Mr. Diouf was imprisoned and deported back to Senegal. Upon his return, he set up the nonprofit AJRAP, Association of Young Repatriates, and has since become an outspoken voice against migration. From his home in Thiaroye-sur-Mer, an impoverished fishing village outside Dakar, Mr. Diouf makes the rounds in schools and community centers across Senegal to spread the word about the dangers of migrating by sea. People here are very poor, he says, but we shouldn't have to do this. Mr. Diouf's campaign is part of a wider effort to reduce both the push and pull of migration. In October of last year, the EU announced that it was giving Senegal £30 million, or $34 million, to help prevent illegal migration to its shores. The money will go toward stopping departures and human trafficking, supporting sea rescues, and educating people about the dangers of migrating by sea. At the same time, Senegal's Marine Corps has begun tracking its waters for illegal fishing, which equally helps detect boats headed for Spain. The EU has also spent more than £160 million, or $185 million, in Senegal since 2015 on efforts to address the root causes of migration, like poverty, poor governance, and insecurity. But the impact has been inconclusive. Now, activists like Mr. Diouf are pushing Senegal's national government to do more to convince young people to stay. He says not enough of the money promised for education and jobs training is actually reaching Senegalese communities. Meanwhile, in towns like Joal and Thiaroye-sur-Mer, the lure of Europe and what it can offer continues to separate the haves and the have-nots. In these towns, most residents live in weathered homes made of sand and clay that flood every time it rains, where flies buzz over fresh meat and open-air courtyards because refrigerators are too expensive. Wooden pirogue boats idle in the bay, while young people do odd jobs, rolling car tires across town or selling bags of tap water to help their parents make ends meet. But on nearly every corner, fancy houses tower above their neighbors. Inside are televisions and washing machines purchased with money sent from abroad. Those with families in Europe sport Nike brand tracksuits and shoes. They needn't worry how the electricity and water bills will get paid at the end of the month. More patrols in Senegalese waters have largely stopped young people from boarding empty fishing boats in coastal towns like Joal and Thiaroye-sur-Mer, say local authorities. But the restrictions have only pushed them into the hands of smugglers on the coast of Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, and Mauritania. Obviously, these kids don't want to risk their lives, says Mr. Diouf, crouching next to a pirogue canoe at Thiaroye-sur-Mer's beach. They're just motivated to have a better life. Back in Tenerife, Abdoulaye has a temporary residency permit and is trying to move forward. He's training to be a chef and works as a translator from Spanish to Wolof to help Senegalese arrivals with the challenges of adjusting to their new European life. His brother Suleimane recently moved to El Hierro with his Spanish wife, who is pregnant with their first child. But Abdullah says their lives in the Canary Islands have at times been extremely hard. He often struggles to pay his rent for the apartment he shares with a handful of other men from Jawal, and every time he goes to the store, it feels like prices have gone up again. This fall, he had a bike accident, hurt his wrist, and hasn't been able to work since. Abdullah tries to convince his little brother, Ibrahima, to be sensible, to wait for his brothers to send him an invitation to come to Spain on a tourist visa or through the family reunification process. It's not just for Ibrahim's sake, but for Pape's too. Abdullah grew up hearing his father's painful migration story. He'd set off for Europe on a fishing boat working illegally at a Spanish port while their mother struggled back in Joal to take care of Abdullah and Suleimani, both just toddlers, by herself. I keep telling my brother to be patient, to wait for the paperwork to go through. We'll buy you an airplane ticket, says Abdullah. Don't come by boat. It's madness. But for Ibrahima, the desire to have what his brothers do in Europe rings louder. Life is really hard here, he says, just out of earshot from his father back in Joal. There's no time to go out, only to go fishing and get enough money to eat. I want to be able to buy things like shoes and nice clothes. Right now, Ibrahima is young. He still listens to me, Pape says. But once he gets older, he'll stop taking my advice. I know he's going to leave one day, too. And a note here, Colette Davidson and Esuli Diediyu reported from Joal and Thierroy-sur-Mer, Senegal, and Ms. Davidson from La Orotava, Tenerife. And, of course, the article itself was written by both Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor, and Esuli Diediyu, who is a contributor at the Monitor. All righty, and here's one more from the world section of today's Monitor. On a lighter note, the headline reads, Zootopia 2 is doing very well in the U.S. It's breaking records in China. Disney has struck gold with the Zootopia franchise, breaking box office records in one of the most profitable but challenging movie markets in the world. The date on this article is December the 12th. It is by Ann Scott Tyson, who is a staff writer at the Monitor, and the dateline is Beijing. In China, they call it Crazy Animal Town. Chinese filmgoers have indeed gone a little bonkers over the Hollywood animated buddy cop comedy Zootopia 2, starring a police officer rabbit named Judy and her partner, a fox named Nick. After watching it, I was extremely excited, says teenager Li Yaling, as he leaves a Beirut theater with his mother and younger brother. That theater is currently screening Zootopia 2 27 times a day. All my friends are going to see it, he says. The Zootopia 2 craze has produced impressive box office numbers. Since opening on November 26, the film has raked in more than $444 million, making it the highest-grossing imported animal film ever released in China. The film also broke the record for the biggest single-day gross for a foreign film in China, a whopping $104 million, according to data from the Chinese ticketing platform Meiyan, cited by China's state-run media. The popularity of Zootopia 2 bucks a broad trend. Over the past decade, domestic-made films have captured an increasing share of the market, edging out Hollywood offerings. That reflects Beijing's tight control over which foreign films are released in China and the government's promotion of patriotic blockbusters such as the Wolf Warrior action series and the Battle of Lake Changjin, which depicts heroic Chinese soldiers fighting Americans in the Korea War. Hollywood has not done well recently in China, says Stanley Rosen, professor of political science at the University of Southern California and an expert in Chinese film. Many Hollywood films are barred by Chinese film regulators or censored, leading some in the U.S. film industry to rethink the China market altogether. Makers of the U.S. films Top Gun Maverick 2022 and Spider-Man No Way Home 2021, for example, rejected Chinese censorship and still made $1.4 billion and $1.9 billion respectively in box office sales globally outside China. Once it was clear that these films were not going to be accepted for China, they had a completely different marketing strategy and did extremely well, says Dr. Rosen. That helped to convince Hollywood they don't really need China so much. Beijing, for its part, remains eager to remind Hollywood of its status as the second biggest film market in the world. The country currently accounts for about 45% of Zootopia 2's worldwide box office sales. Still, other Hollywood films have had a hard time matching the enthusiasm surrounding Zootopia 2. Chinese moviegoers are even bringing their dogs and other pets to special showings in several cities, spurring social media posts featuring furry animals and their owners bouncing to the theme song Zoo by Shakira. So why the frenzy over Crazy Animal Town? One reason is the popularity of the first Zootopia, released in 2016. Mr. Lee saw that film when he was about 7 years old and has never forgotten it. The last time I was so excited, so happy, he raves, adding that this one is a significant improvement in quality. Moreover, a generation of young people captivated by Zootopia nearly a decade ago now have children of their own and want to bring them to see the sequel. I really liked the first one, so when the second one came out, I wanted to bring my child, says Zhang Ryu, a telecommunications company worker who saw the movie with her six-year-old daughter. Capitalizing on that success, Disney opened the world's only Zootopia land at the Shanghai Disney Resort in late 2023, attracting flocks of fans. Everyone watched the first movie, then went to Disneyland to play at Zootopia, and is now watching the sequel, says Ms. Zhang. Disney is also marketing Zootopia 2 in China with special short preview films and a Zootopia-themed aircraft, the Disney Utopia Express, unveiled as part of the China Eastern Airlines fleet. Theaters are selling all sorts of merchandise, from Zootopia keychains and phone cases to dolls and snacks. The overall popularity of animated films in China is another factor in the success of Zootopia 2. It follows this year's Chinese automation sensation, Ne Zha 2, the world's highest-grossing movie in 2025, with $1.8 billion in Chinese earnings. As for the film's message, Ms. Zhang appreciates how Zootopia touches on deeper themes such as overwhelming social ostracism and personality conflicts, although they might be over the head of children her daughter's age. Children might not grasp the layers of meaning, she says. Yet that depth is also part of what gives Zootopia 2 its broad audience appeal in China, moviegoers say. The protagonists are very brave, intelligent, and witty, says Ms. Liu, a university-educated Chinese teacher in her 20s who declined to give her first name to protect her privacy. She was a fan of the first Zootopia. Their personal charm is what makes the film so appealing and charismatic, she says. It's the spirit they embody. And once again, this particular article is by Ann Scott Tyson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move right over to the USA section of today's Monitor. And from there, our first headline reads, "For California, a first, formal role for public in fire recovery policymaking." Participants in California's deliberative democracy model prioritized permitting resilience and financial support as foundations of fire recovery. The date on this article is December the 16th. It is by Allie Martin, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is Los Angeles. In the aftermath of the Los Angeles wildfires, California is trying a new approach to crafting the recovery, a first-of-its-kind attempt for the state, leaders say, to involve the public in policymaking. Emerging from a disaster as large as the wildfires generally falls to agencies and elected officials, California is offering a vehicle for the public to help shape whatever comes next with a pilot program called Engaged California. The state harnessed online discussions to give policymakers a data-driven picture of the public's opinions, suggestions, and priorities. The result, says an administrator, is something residents can use to hold their government leaders accountable. Engage California released an action plan in November based on input from 3,000 Angelenos over a six-month period. The process used a form of deliberative democracy, which invites communities to participate in decision-making by sharing opinions and then talking and listening to each other. The conversation was incredibly civil, incredibly productive, says Jeffrey Marino, director of California's Office of Data and Innovation, which runs the effort with a coalition including the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The effort may be a model for cutting through political polarization and the public's waning trust in government, which is at historic lows. In a recent Pew Research Center poll, 17% of respondents said they trusted federal leaders to do what was right. Deliberative democracy, which can be traced back to Aristotle, has succeeded in other countries and in the U.S. In Ireland, for example, citizens' assemblies work closely with parliament. Fort Collins, Colorado, used it to develop a strategic housing plan. In an era of ideological intransigence, purposeful discussion can move people towards greater tolerance for each other's beliefs, says James Fishkin, director of the Deliberative Democracy Lab at Stanford University, which advised Engage California. The lab's work includes introducing the process to Mongolia, which now requires it as a part of the country's constitutional amendment process. It increases trust generally, it increases respect for the people you disagree with most strongly, and it increases the tendency to vote, Professor Fishkin said. Deliberative democracy is intended to build consensus and strengthen connections between lawmakers and the people they govern. If done well, say advocates, the public creates a problem-solving agenda and then find solutions rather than leaders trying to convince the public of their vision. Institutes like the Center for Public Deliberation at Colorado State University administer these deliberations for local governments or nonprofits. Generally, the process involves two parts, a survey of participants to determine what needs consideration, and then a deeper guided discussion. Administrators randomly select the players, who are often paid for their time. Ideally, the makeup of the group matches community demographics. Engage California adhered to the two-part process of survey and discussion, but in order to hear from as many people as possible, it lowered barriers to participation. Demographic information was requested but not required. People were able to skip survey questions, and the online discussion forum was not held in real time. When a community comes together to find solutions for collective issues, partisan identities tend to melt away, says Sabrina Slagowski-Tipton, the Colorado State Center's managing director. We very rarely hear at an event, "I'm a Republican and here's why I feel this way," or "I'm a Democrat and I want to talk about this." But the process is labor-intensive and takes time, like the two-year-long project she worked on for Fort Collins that resulted in a housing plan, including adoption of new land use codes. Transparency about how the input is used has a big impact, she says, and citizens are more willing to have good faith discussions with local agencies than go through the deliberation, even when they have complaints. More and more people are also just realizing how important it is and how fulfilling it is to feel like you're part of your community, she said. The Los Angeles wildfire struck in January as Engage California was preparing to launch on a different subject. Administrators saw an opportunity to support the fire recovery, says Mr. Marino. City leaders pushed back, he says, suggesting it could backfire. Instead of thoughtful discussion, there could be anger. The opposite happened. Less than 5% of the online conversation had to be suppressed, and much of that was due to people posting business links, not spewing vitriol. Another surprise was the agreement among participants. Despite broad differences in the two communities most impacted by the fires, they expressed the same priorities. They wanted support in terms of fast-tracking, permitting, getting more financial support, while at the same time building for resilience, Mr. Marino said. The November report delivered a plan with five focus areas: burying power lines and equipment underground, improving water systems for fighting fire, improving emergency communications, helping survivors connect with financial support programs, and helping residents get permits so they can rebuild. Some participants were critical of what they say is a government program out of touch with the people it's trying to help. Joy Chen, a former deputy mayor of Los Angeles who heads the nonprofit Eaton Fire Survivors Network, called the platform disappointing. "There was not a place that it seemed like they were collecting our actual priorities," she says. "They're asking, well, what do you think about our priorities being state government, as opposed to, I'm concerned about your priorities." Each of the report's focus areas, for instance, links to steps that are already underway to address those issues, like executive orders issued by Governor Gavin Newsom and L.A. Mayor Karen Bass to ease permitting, and a state order that was signed in March to fast-track burying power lines in the burn areas. Mr. Marino acknowledges some challenges. Participants weren't paid, which meant the process was open to whoever had the time and inclination, as opposed to administrators being able to control for demographics. And then there's skepticism, the idea that your government is saying, no, trust us this time, we really mean it this time, he says. But, he says, the online engagement allowed all types of voices to be heard, and not just the loudest ones. And the Office of Data and Innovation, which runs Engage California, turned that engagement into information that policymakers used as they were coming up with plans to rebuild. Along with the report, the state has published more than 1,500 public comments, including these, which are edited for brevity. There's a list of comments here. The first comment: if folks can't afford to rent somewhere, they should get an easy-to-access free permit to stay on their property in a tiny house or ADU, accessory dwelling unit, while their house gets rebuilt. Comment two: what warning systems? Palisades had evacuation routes, only there weren't nearly enough of them. Comment three: knowing a full week in advance that winds were coming, there was no excuse for LA Fire to wait until fires had begun before deploying. Next comment: this is an opportunity to apply lessons learned from here and other cities around the world and to modernize infrastructure. The final report established a record of what people say are their top priorities for recovery. The program's next topic is already underway, enlisting state employees to help make California's government more effective and efficient. The deliberative democracy process not only tells you what people think, but why they think it, says Professor Fishkin, and that in itself can have an effect when people think about the issue. If we see that as a way to sort of cure the extreme partisan divisions and to get people to think about the issues, we could actually greatly improve our democracy. And again, this particular article is by Allie Martin, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving on to our next headline from the USA section of today's Monitor, it reads, "No one has faced trial for 2020 fake electors plan. In Wisconsin, it might happen." Criminal cases over a, quote, fake elector scheme to keep Donald Trump in office after his 2020 election loss have mostly run aground. In Wisconsin, a case involving three key figures in the effort might be headed for trial. The date on this article is December the 13th. It is by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. The effort to overturn the 2020 election by organizing slates of alternate electors for President Donald Trump began in the swing state of Wisconsin. Now, the fitful attempt to hold those organizers accountable might hang on what happens there. On Monday, three people charged in what became known as the fake electors plan are in court for a pretrial hearing in a case that is one of a vanishing few still moving forward. Trump electors were central to the campaign's attempt on January 6 to prevent Joe Biden from being certified as winner of the 2020 election. Mr. Trump's lawyers sought to strong-arm Vice President Mike Pence into delaying the vote tally by Congress on the grounds that several states, including Wisconsin, had submitted dual slates of electors. Those electors represent each state's actual votes for president. If Mr. Pence, presiding over the vote tally in Congress, had agreed to Mr. Trump's demand to account to count the alternate slates or to let Congress decide the winner, Mr. Trump could have remained in office despite Mr. Biden's receiving more votes. After Mr. Pence refused, a crowd of Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol. Nearly 5 years on, no campaign officials or advisors have been tried for organizing the fake electors in seven battleground states. A court in Georgia recently ended a criminal case in which Mr. Trump and 18 other defendants had been indicted in August 2023 for racketeering and other offenses. In September, a judge in Michigan dismissed a case against 15 Republicans charged with fraud for certifying Mr. Trump as the 2020 winner. Criminal prosecutions in other states have stalled or faced setbacks. That makes Wisconsin a potential test case for accountability for what was considered a national crisis of democratic legitimacy, which continues to cast a shadow over how America's elections are run. Last year, Wisconsin charged three Trump allies over the fake electors scheme. Two, James Troupas and Kenneth Chesbrough, were attorneys for the Trump campaign. The third, Michael Roman, was Trump's National Director of Election Day Operations. They each face 11 counts of alleged forgery, each carrying prison terms. The three were among 77 people pardoned last month by Mr. Trump for all conduct related to the scheme and their efforts to expose voting fraud and vulnerabilities in the 2020 presidential election. That pardon, largely symbolic because none face federal charges, doesn't apply, however, to state courts. Mr. Trump also pardoned or commuted the sentences of more than 1,500 people charged in connection with the January 6th attack. None of the 10 fake electors who met secretly in Wisconsin Statehouse on December 14, 2020, as the state's legitimate electors were casting their votes for Mr. Biden, had been charged. Instead, Wisconsin prosecutors are focusing on the people who developed the fake elector strategy. It was these lawyers in Wisconsin who cooked up the whole scheme and exported it to the rest of the country, says Jeff Mandel, a co-founder of Law Forward, a left-leaning law firm in Madison, Wisconsin. In 2023, Wisconsin faked electors settled a civil lawsuit brought by Law Forward admitting to their role in the scheme. Mr. Troupas, a retired judge who was Mr. Trump's attorney in Wisconsin, and Mr. Chesbrough, a New York attorney who has since been disbarred, were both part of the settlement. It included the release of emails, texts, and memos that detailed how Mr. Chesbrough's legal theory of alternate electors was enthusiastically adopted by Mr. Troupas and shared with the Trump campaign. Mr. Chesbrough then provided templates for other states to prepare slates of electors for Mr. Trump. They knew what they were doing, and now they're trying to escape the consequences, says Mr. Mandel, referring to defense motions to dismiss the case. Joseph Bugney, a lawyer for Mr. Troupas, declined to comment on the felony charges. Lawyers for Mr. Chesbrough and Mr. Roman didn't respond to emailed requests for comment. Mr. Troupas criticized Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call after his indictment, telling reporters at the courthouse that this is a political case. This has nothing to do with the law. He accused Mr. Call, a Democrat first elected in 2019, of hurting the cause of justice. Last month, he told Steve Bannon's The War Room show that Democrats wanted to put him on trial so that they could revive the Jack Smith case, referring to the federal indictment of Mr. Trump for attempting to overturn the 2020 elections, which was abandoned after the 2024 election. They're going to try the Jack Smith case in Dane County, Wisconsin, next summer on live TV, he said. Mr. Troupas and others involved in the scheme have argued that Democrats did the same in 1960 when they were uncertain about Hawaii's presidential electors. Of the two slates of electors submitted to Congress, the votes ultimately went to John F. Kennedy. But this analogy doesn't hold water, says Michael Rosen, an independent legal scholar who has studied the 1960 election. Hawaii was holding a recount at the time, whereas Wisconsin had already held a recount that affirmed Mr. Biden's narrow victory. The electors in Hawaii met openly in the same room with the state's governor, who certified both sets of paperwork. In 1960, it was very important to the new state of Hawaii to do everything right, he says. The Republican electors in Wisconsin could have inserted legal language that made their votes conditional on the election results being reviewed by the Supreme Court, he says, but their slate would still not have been certified as alternate electors as Hawaii's was in 1960. This was just a fantasy on the part of Cheeseborough that they could change the path of Wisconsin and elsewhere, Mr. Rosen said. Mr. Cheeseborough was also among those indicted in Georgia's election interference case. He pleaded guilty in October 2023 to a single charge and agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. By then, Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis had become a national political figure who seemed poised to bring Mr. Trump to trial. Mr. Cheeseborough's inside knowledge of the fake elector scheme, also pursued in Georgia, made him an important potential witness. But Ms. Willis suffered a spectacular fall a few months later after it was revealed that she had hired a special prosecutor for the case with whom she was romantically involved. She was removed from the case last December. A judge ended the case last month after Ms. Willis' replacement said it wasn't feasible to proceed, as Mr. Trump's presidential term would delay any trial for several years, depriving defendants of their right to a speedy trial. The legal question is really secondary to the practical question, says Anthony Michael Kreis, an associate professor of law at Georgia State University who has followed the case. Mr. Trump's criminal indictment in Georgia, where he had urged the state's top election official in 2020 to find sufficient votes to flip the outcome, became fuel for his political comeback in 2024. Supporters rallied to defend him against what he called, quote, lawfare by Democratic prosecutors, and his campaign swept aside opponents in the Republican primary. His campaign sold branded items featuring Mr. Trump's booking mugshot from Fulton County. That the Georgia case has collapsed is regrettable, and not simply because justice has not run its course, says Professor Kreis. He says the trial would have served another purpose, setting the record straight about an election that Mr. Trump still falsely claims he won. It was fundamentally, in my view, a moment of potential reconciliation where people could see through evidence for their own selves that there was a group of people who were lying to the American public in order to keep themselves in power, he says. In 2022, Congress amended the Electoral Count Act to clarify the vice president's ceremonial role in the certification of votes in Congress. After the presidential election of 2028, Vice President J.D. Vance, who is expected to seek the GOP nomination, would preside over that process. Mr. Vance said last year that had he been in Mr. Pence's position, he would not have certified the 2020 election results, and that states should have submitted multiple slates that Congress should have fought over. Mr. Mandel says he doesn't expect a future presidential candidate to try another fake elector scheme, but he argues that it is still important to hold the Wisconsin masterminds of 2020 to account after Mr. Trump issued preemptive federal pardons. If the message is, quote, no harm, no foul, we create the incentives for something more extreme next time, he said. And again, this particular article was by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. And with that, it looks like we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you taking some time out from your day to spend some time with me listening to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with more from the Christian Science Monitor at the end of the week. Thank you for listening.